Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. The Founding Fathers are under attack. Who knew in 2009, when I wrote my first book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers, that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and a litany of the other Founding Fathers would be under assault today? Well, I did, and that's why I wrote that book. It's my first, it's still my bestseller. Going out and pick it up whenever books are sold online. The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers. You'll really enjoy it. Do we have a secret Hamiltonian in the White House? Well, we'll talk about that on this episode of The Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to The Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to be back on the program. Very glad to be here. Well, according to the New York Times, we have a secret Hamiltonian in the White House. A secret Hamiltonian. Like this is, you know, clandestine to have a Hamiltonian in the executive office. I wrote an entire book on this. Here it is. How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America, if you're watching. We've had a Hamiltonian in the White House for a long time. In fact, the piece even points that out that I'm going to read to you from the New York Times. But apparently Joe Biden is trying to hide this. Now, what's really curious, of course, is Donald Trump claimed to be a Hamiltonian the entire time he was there. As one of his great intellectual heirs in many ways. So we've always had a Hamiltonian in the White House. In fact, I say always. We've had a Hamiltonian in the White House at least since the 1860s. Now, you could say there's been some periods of time where we had someone, you know, there's been an ebb and flow, and one of the more important examples is Grover Cleveland, who was probably the last Jeffersonian in the White House, so you could make a case maybe for Woodrow Wilson, at least in his, the person that he said was his greatest influence. You know, Wilson, the progressive, actually claimed Jefferson over Hamilton, but regardless, those are the exceptions rather than the rule. I mean, we've had Hamiltonians in the White House and Hamilton controlling American government really since 1791. Now, this piece is going to be very laudatory of that, and I'll talk about that as we go through it, but this is no secret. I find it fascinating that anyone would say we have a secret Hamiltonian. It's been an open secret if it's a secret for a long time. It's just that Americans don't really understand the influence of Alexander Hamilton and how Hamilton really did lead to the destruction of the original federal order. You see, the problem is, and this is going to focus, this piece is going to focus almost exclusively on economics, but the problem is Hamilton's vision, this Hamiltonian vision, is the primary reason why the United States is in this headlong rush towards nationalism, centralization, destruction of federalism, suppression of civil liberties, I mean, all that. That's Alexander Hamilton. It's either coming through the policies of the central government or the Supreme Court. That's why I wrote the book. Now, that book came out 8 years ago now. But we've had a Hamiltonian in the White House for a long time. Now, I could have focused this particular podcast on Joe Biden's State of the Union address, and I thought about that. But what's the point? So let me just mention that very quickly today, because I know some of y'all were looking for my review of that particular speech. It's not a State of the Union address. That was a campaign speech. There wasn't really anything about the State of the Union. It's the format has become tired. You bring people out to the gallery. You point them out. You have, you know, people stand and clap at all kinds of stupid things. it's real political theater and it's boring. It really is boring. And why anybody would pay attention to this thing is beyond me. It also smacks of monarchy, which, by the way, is very Hamiltonian. If you want to talk about a Hamiltonian in the White House, we'll just look at the way we've shifted how we get the State of the Union. This started with Wilson, again, who Jefferson was supposedly his guy, but Wilson started reading the State of the Union address before Congress, just as you would in Great Britain. If you don't understand the tradition there, the Constitution requires that the president give, from time to time, an address essentially about the State of the Union. It's what we call the State of the Union. They used to call it the annual message to Congress. Well, Washington delivered it in person, so did John Adams. But Jefferson said, that's too monarchical. Let's stop doing that. So from the time of Thomas Jefferson in 1801, when he became president, until Woodrow Wilson in 1913, so you're talking over 100 years, no one gave the State of the Union address in person to Congress. Wilson changed that. He invited both houses of Congress there and the Supreme Court. Now, I thought the Supreme Court was supposed to be independent, but now they have to go sit through this thing. They have to listen to the king give an address and how to influence the court, which is going to then decide what the Constitution is for the rest of the United States. And again, this is very British. The king now, or queen for 70 years, would demand that the House of Commons come over to the House of Lords and listen to an annual message. It's like a State of the Union. This is, I mean, you see the British antecedents in all of this. The English antecedents. This is what we had. I mean, it smacks of monarchy. But the speech was simply just a campaign address. I mean, Joe Biden made it clear he's running for president, and this is going to be all about the things he needs to do, and go vote for people for Congress. And it wasn't a State of the Union address. It was written at the level of, you know, a 12-year-old, because that's about the extent of American reading comprehension. And even the Washington Post went through and ripped it apart for the various lies and exaggerations in the speech, which is always going to happen in a campaign speech. You're not really talking about the State of the Union. I mean, it's full of exclamation points. The State of the Union is strong. The State of the Union is strong. Hey, you know what? I'm going to yell a little more. The State of the Union is strong. If I say it enough, it's going to mean it. It's a ridiculous speech. And of course, watching all these people, as I said, imagine having to stand and clap for any of this stuff. It's a joke. So let's get into this idea that Biden really is a Hamiltonian, though. Is Biden a Hamiltonian? Now, historically, the Democrats have wanted to be the party of Jefferson and Jackson. Now, they've dropped that. But they've been the party of Hamilton for a long time. In fact, you could say that, you know, Hamilton did win. Their belief that the Supreme Court should be the final arbiter of everything, that the Supreme Court, unless they disagree with it, right? I mean, now they're upset with the Supreme Court, need to abolish the Supreme Court after the ruling on Colorado, Trump v. Anderson. We got to get rid of the Supreme Court. But for the most part, this has been their vehicle to get what they want. When it doesn't work, we got to abolish it, we got to pack the court, we got to do this and that. I mean, now the left is completely unhinged on the court. But that's the only way they've really been able to get what they want in their social agenda, have it foisted on the United States, is through the court, because if they had to go through the regular legislative process, they wouldn't get it. And you go back, and as I talk about in the book, you've got three judges really responsible for that: John Marshall, Joseph Story, and Hugo Black. Now, all John Marshall did and Joseph Story did was simply regurgitate Alexander Hamilton. In fact, Marshall, in his most famous ruling, which expanded federal power, McCulloch v. Maryland, which of course had to do with a bank, which was Hamiltonian, just simply regurgitated and restated Alexander Hamilton in his defense of the bank in 1791. It's all he did. He, in fact, told Daniel Webster how to argue based on Alexander Hamilton. So, behind the scenes, I mean, this was going on. And Joseph Story, who was appointed, actually, by Madison, sounded very much like Alexander Hamilton in his commentaries on the Constitution. In fact, Joseph Story's arguments in favor of a strong central government were based on the anti-federalists who were arguing against the Constitution and things that said that they were afraid were happening, and the proponents of the document said would never happen. But Joseph Story said, well, this is clear, then, this is the Constitution. See, they said this is going to happen. This is what we got. This is what it's supposed to be. I mean, it's hilarious. But Story, the Supreme Court justice and, of course, legal scholar, made more money writing the commentaries and selling that than he ever did serving on the bench. And then Hugo Black, the progressives. Well, the progressives, what are they? Are they Jeffersonian or Hamiltonian? Well, if you read Herbert Crowley, and if you've taken my American Progressives class at McClanahan Academy, this is why I spent so much time on Herbert Crowley. Hamilton was his guy. So was Abraham Lincoln. What do they have in common? Well, they're Hamiltonians. Hamilton, of course, would be, but Lincoln was a Hamiltonian. What do they have in common? And Hugo Black, the progressive, was well-versed in progressive ideology and, of course, progressive intellectual history. He knew it. Now, this piece is going to talk about economics. And yes, we have a Hamiltonian economic system in the United States, which was essentially, again, foisted on the United States in 1862, when the Republicans had no further opposition in the Congress. They could do whatever they wanted. This was the Hamiltonian Party. Lincoln was a professed Whig, and the Whigs believed in the Hamiltonian system. The Whigs are interesting because Henry Clay always said he was a Jeffersonian, but what he really was, in many ways, was a Hamiltonian Jeffersonian, right? He's a national Republican. He believed in the American system, which the piece is going to get into. It's very Hamiltonian in its outlook. Jefferson, of course, had opposed that. The Republicans were against it. And they were against it because they were agriculturalists, but they were also against it because they said it was destroying the Federal Republic, and it was creating this monstrosity, this central authority that had unlimited power, unchecked and unlimited power. And once we got to that point, what's the difference in the British model or the United States? What's the difference between being a colonial subject of the British or being a colonial subject of the United States government? There isn't any. This is their entire point. There isn't any. And in fact, this piece is going to kind of make that clear. We don't really have a free market system in America. We have a mercantilist system. We've had that for a couple hundred years. We have an American mercantilist system, just like the British have or had, and it picks winners and losers. This is what William Graham Sumner points out in the late 19th century, and the assault on the common man, right? The forgotten man is what he called it, but the man in the middle who's squeezed by those who make profits from the policies of the center, that would be the state capitalists. This would be those that benefit from the mercantilist system. And then those at the bottom who are receiving subsidies for other things, whether it's kind of, you know, welfare support, whatever it is. That's who these people are. They squeeze the guy in the middle. Now, of course, if you listen to the socialists, the Marxists, well, all these middle-class people get jobs out of it. And look, the United States, the government on all levels now is the largest employer in the United States. More people are working for government than anything else. And they're making more money. I mean, in terms of the average salary you work for government, you make more money than you do in the private sector now. You've got government employees being a huge section of the American population. A huge section. When you talk about state, local, federal, I mean, people working for government is huge. And you have to count, you know, among those teachers, police officers, firefighters, the military. All levels of government. You've got. And then, of course, when you factor in government contracts, which is a whole other thing, right? So they're kind of working for the government, too. If you look at the defense industry, how much money do we spend on that? Or other government contracts. You know, we don't build roads without government contracts. All of those people are chasing government contracts. It's all government money. And in fact, the piece points that out. So we have government, in one way or another, being a huge employer in the United States. And this, of course, is great, according to the author. Now, what does that lead to? Of course, massive corruption, inflation, unconstitutional spending, unconstitutional expansion of government, massive centralization of power, the suppression of civil liberties. This is what it leads to all the time. It's, again, the whole point of how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America. But let's go ahead and talk about this piece. It's written by Jacob Solis at the New York Times. Jacob Soule is a professor of philosophy at University of Southern California. He also is he's a professor of philosophy, history, and accounting, which is interesting. I mean, three things thrown in together. He wrote a book entitled Free Market, The History of an Idea. Everybody's writing about these history of ideas. How ideas change the world. This is Richard Weaver. Ideas have consequences, right? So he says, President Biden has been called a lot of things, but Hamiltonian is not usually one of them, unless you're me. Right? Let me say something about the book, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America. When I wrote that book, I thought this thing could be a real game changer in how we thought about the general government. Now, and I think there were people who in the publishing world, or at least those who published it, who thought the same thing. It was why they pitched it and promoted it, why I pitched it, and of course they got it. But I think that there's a real disconnect in the conservative movement in America. It's published by a conservative publisher. The conservative movement to realize that Hamilton is not really one of them. Now, Russell Kirk does talk about Alexander Hamilton and the conservative mind, but he doesn't really say that Hamilton is, when you look for American conservatives, is the guy. I mean, Kirk was more comfortable with the Adams, for example, in the North, and definitely in the South, someone like Randolph and Calhoun. But conservatives have this belief that Hamilton is one of them. If you go read American progressive literature, Hamilton is one of them. And I think this is the problem with Hamilton. He's one of everybody. And when that happens, you get a big fat Frankenstein. And of course, you get that when you throw in the Jeffersonian part, which is what Crowley starts doing. Well, Hamilton is great on everything, but he's a little too aristocratic. We got to have Jeffersonian democracy thrown in here, and then we get real Americanism. That's the promise of American life. Hamilton has always been the guy of the left. He's always been the innovator. He's always been the person that's looking to try to take constraints and do away with them, to centralize power, to make it a nasty monstrosity. I mean, Biden is a Hamiltonian. Everybody in Washington, D.C., in fact, now, is pretty much a Hamiltonian, except for a few people that realize that Hamilton is a disaster. So the piece says, Jacob Soule says, in spite of his economic successes, this is Biden, hardly anyone has thought to compare the president to the architect of the American economy. All of his economic successes. Yes, economic successes right now. We are looking at an economy that's a real success. We've got inflation every year at least 3%. Why? Because we have a Hamiltonian system. I mean, Hamilton, of course, would have been at least theoretically opposed to any kind of high inflation. But we know the policies that he espouses is going to bring us that. I mean, central banking is going to get it. Fractional reserve banking creates it. And then when you get state control of the banking system entirely, you're going to get it. Now, we know that the populace and others were not necessarily against inflation. They wanted to have free coinage of silver, which would create more money, which, of course, would lead to a little bit of inflation. They didn't want deflation. But Hamilton's scheme of corruption is what we get. Right? But so I've compared Joe Biden to Alexander Hamilton. I've compared all these fools in the White House to Alexander Hamilton because they all are. Hardly anyone. Well, I mean, I guess there are some. Me and others. There's a few others. And yet more than any president in generations, Mr. Biden shares Alexander Hamilton's fundamental vision for the country. America needs a strong industrial strategy to support its long-term security. You see, more than any president in generation. That's pretty funny because what did Donald Trump talk about on the campaign trail when he was running for president in 2016, and of course even 2020, manufacturing. But Biden is the guy. Biden is the man that's going to go out there and bring us manufacturing. Even the Washington Post pointed out that in the fact check on his speech, and manufacturing is up. It's actually down. It was down and it's come back, but some of that has to do with the way the economy tanked in 2020. Why? Because we're pumping, we shut everything down, pumping so much money in the economy. So then Sol says, Mr. Biden's CHIPS and Science Act and his Inflation Reduction Act reflect this idea. The Inflation Reduction Act is the greatest piece of Orwellian legislation in the history of the United States. Because all it did is create inflation. Didn't reduce inflation. It created inflation. It basically makes inflation permanent. It's not reducing anything. We know inflation is still 3% a year. Well, McClanahan, it was 9%. Now it's down to 3%. Why was it 9%? Because we pumped so much money in the economy. And they're still doing it. They're running the printing presses. You're not going to reduce any inflation unless you cut spending and stop running the presses. Then you'll see reduction in inflation. And Biden, of course, saying inflation now is the lowest in the Western world. No, it's not. Even the Washington Post pointed that. You've got places in Europe where inflation is 1% or less. We're at three. And so, that's generous saying we're at three. We're probably at a little higher than that. It depends on which area you're looking at. People know inflation is high. These policies, of course, these pieces of legislation, channel government money into the semiconductor, solar energy, and electric vehicle sectors in the hope of reducing reliance on foreign producers and bolstering national security while helping American companies become more competitive with Chinese state-subsidized industries. Now, you go back to John Taylor of Caroline. Again, if you get my American populism class, he talks about this. This is subsidies. These are bounties, he calls them. All that you do when you create the bounties is you create winners and losers. You destroy agriculture, which is what these things do. You destroy other parts of the American economy. And think about it. The electric vehicle sector? Why? There's all kinds of information about electric cars being more polluting than regular gasoline-powered cars. People don't want these things. They have less resale value because you got to replace the batteries, which is thousands and thousands of dollars. You got to get all the lithium for them, which, of course, is cobalt, which is disastrous for the economy, or for the environment, I should say. You got to get all that stuff out of it. You can't run these things in cold weather. They're a disaster. Electric cars really are a disaster. You had the Ford Lightning, which was supposed to change everything. The hype was tremendous. Even I was looking at it and saying, wow, this is pretty interesting. People that got these things, they can't pull anything. They wear out very quickly. You're stuck with a hunk of junk. And yet, so far, we're changing the world. We're basically putting bounties into the hands of big business who are chasing the money. Just as you would do with tariffs. Why can't these places compete with other parts of the world on their own accord? And you know who wins from that? Well, the American consumer who has to buy these things. When you put bounties on it, you increase the prices. And then, of course, you'll say, well, we can give you a tax break for buying this. You're still paying more for it. Liberals are calling this government intervention the end of neoliberalism. It's a strange statement. It'd be neo-mercantilism more than anything else. I don't think it's the end of neo-mercantilism. It's just, you're just doubling down. And a new securonomics. Securonomics. What a stupid word. But of course, that's what the left is calling this. While conservatives are claiming that dangerous Bidenomics policies are hurting the economy and are an affront to the free market. In spite of this, by all indications, the policies seem to be working and Republican states are benefiting. No one said that Republican states, that the states themselves are not addicted to the cash, as this points out. Ohio, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Texas are taking billions in federal funds from the Inflation Reduction Act and are reaping the rewards of the creation of tens of thousands of green energy jobs. taking the cash. You want to stop the extreme centralization of power, you've got to get the states off the cash. It's the only way to do it. But they're not going to do it. They won't do it. So he says, as an economic historian, I can't help being struck that this argument over industrial policy versus unfettered free markets has happened before during the presidency of George Washington. That's a real simplistic way to look at this. Industrial policy over unfettered free markets. That's a horrible argument in many ways. It's a horrible statement. Yes, there were those that were Jeffersonians that believed in free markets. They believed in a market-driven economy. In fact, they weren't just Jeffersonians. New England was pushing this too. And when the Jeffersonians began pushing for an embargo, they were the ones that were very opposed to it, right? Because they have the commercial side wrapped up. But then, of course, it made clear that, well, New England's going to start manufacturing things, and they all of a sudden became supportive of tariffs. You see, it just matters whatever New England wants is what we get. Unfettered free markets, no. It's also hard to ignore the irony that Republican champions of historical originalism are attacking an economic playbook that looks much like the one written in 1791 by Hamilton when he was Washington's Secretary of the Treasury. Well, that's because that's not originalism. Hamilton wasn't an originalist, at least not by the time he got to the Secretary of the Treasury position. In fact, September 11th, 1789 is one of the turning points in American history. It's the other of September 11th because that's when Hamilton was appointed as Secretary of Treasury. Hamilton wasn't an originalist. He argued for positions in favoring the bank and the tariffs and everything else that were not originalists. This is what was pointed out. This is not what the Constitution allows us to do. It's not originalism. While some historians have called Hamilton's project for state support of American manufacturing a failure, it wasn't a failure. It's what we got. I agree with him here. This never was a failure. It's what we ultimately got. The blip was the Jeffersonian position when they resisted most of this stuff. And then, of course, and you had people that were pointing out why it was a problem. Wait. Filtered into the courts and everything else, because you're going to get unlimited federal power. It's always won. It's why Alexander Hamilton screwed up America. It's always worked. The reality is that Hamilton's plan was not only successful at the time, true, it also successful in terms of getting it through. Now, I don't know if it's successful, but it also laid a template for almost two centuries of security-driven economic policy, which Mr. Biden is merely revamping. True. Alexander Hamilton screwed up America, but not security-driven economic policy. Are Americans more secure today in terms of their economic power than they were, 70 years ago because of inflation? Are they more secure? I mean, we can talk about this. Are we more secure? Is Hamilton better? We can have this conversation, but I think that, again, this piece is creating a straw. Most historians don't believe this. Most historians, straw man. He's knocking over straw man. Maybe this is true, but if you had my book, you would know. Since the dawn of competition between militarized early industrial states in the 15th and 16th centuries, government economic strategy in the face of relatively hostile trading partners and even allies has paid major dividends for national wealth. So again, this is the point of mercantilism, right? National wealth. How do you measure wealth? What Sol is actually displaying here is that he's a mercantilist. That's all Hamilton was. He was a mercantilist. He was a state capitalist, but he wasn't really a free market capitalist. He's a mercantilist. Wealth, if you think about the economic policies, which he actually talks about, and some of the others. Let me get into that, because the history is interesting. England had a long history of state involvement in the economy. True. With roots in Henry VII's wool subsidies and protections, as well as monopolies under Elizabeth I. Absolutely true. Because they were mercantilists. With the rise of imperial military competition in the 17th century, the wealth-bolstering relationship between trade and security became much more apparent. Or between bounties for your supporters. This is how you buy off people. the kings and the queens bought support from the middle class against the nobility. This is what they were doing. It's how it worked. They bought the merchant class, or I should say the merchant class, not really the middle class, but the merchant class. They bought the bankers. They bought the industrialists to oppose the landed estates. That's how it worked. And they created wealth for the quote-unquote nation, which means what? The government. For the government. Who gets wealthy? The government. Who also gets wealthy? They're winners. Those who are following the cash, they're sycophants. That's who gets wealthy. All the billionaires in America, how many of them have built that on the back of government subsidies, or at least government choosing in one way or another? We know Elon Musk has. I did a whole podcast on that. Way, way back, I talked about Elon Musk in that way. We know this is true. I remember driving in my car when Obama was president, and there was some talk about Elon Musk and all the money he was making on government subsidies. Yes. Yes. Global commercial players could not compete in seaborne trade without industries that supported the Navy. Ships were a precursor to high-tech industry. I mean, they needed complex parts, navigational technology, refined weaponry, a large-skilled workforce and managerial staff, and immerse industrial ports and cities, which required state-supported monopolies, companies, and subsidies. This is all mercantilism, right? It's all mercantilism. You pick winners and losers. This is all true. Hamilton was a mercantilist. In 1651, England passes navigation laws to protect its shipping and fishing industries and to promote its national prowess. Now, what was one of the great antagonisms of the American War for Independence? Let me think about that for a second. Oh yeah, monopolies. The Tea Act was a monopoly. This is why they opposed it. You see, the American experience was opposed to this mercantilist system, at least in the late 18th century. This is what several historians have pointed out. The Jeffersonians were certainly opposed to this kind of thing, even though, as Jefferson was eventually supporting manufacturing. A lot of Jeffersonians supported manufacturing in and of itself, but when you put state subsidies in it, then they oppose it. You can have manufacturing if it just can exist on its own. You don't subsidize it, because when you subsidize it, you create a big monster. A decade later, Louis XIV's finance minister, Jean-Baptiste Colbert, emulated England's long history of tariffs, subsidies, and state industrial involvement that had given it advantages in wool shipping and cannon making. When Colbert died in 1683, France had a superior navy and was in the process of becoming England's major competitor in the textile market. The new countries had become Europe's premier powers. I mean, look, this is true. But by the time we get to the 18th century, and you look at what happens with John Law and some of the others that France would employ, I mean, this created massive inflation and all kinds of other things. Look, the French Revolution was only possible because of all of these economic forces. It's also interesting to note 1651, right? What's going on at that point? What's happening in 1651? You've got the Protectorate. You've got the king out of the way. The merchant class has now risen to power. And they're protecting their own interests. 1651. The Protectorate. Interesting, right? The Puritans were controlling the government. By the end of the 18th century, America was at the center of this competition for global dominance, with the young United States reeling from the Revolutionary War and still facing economic and military threats from the British imperial behemoth. President Washington asked Congress in 1790 to promote such manufacturers so that the country would be self-reliant, particularly for military supplies. America had suffered from war supply shortages, and its leaders remained concerned by the British Prohibitory Act of 1775, a commercial blockade that had left the country unable to obtain basic staples along with technological and military necessities. And then Hamilton produces his report on the subject of manufacturers, which of course, Saul says it was rebuttal of laissez-faire economics and a blueprint for American state industrial policy. This is true. He was a mercantilist. It's American mercantilism. He challenged Adam Smith. This is true. Of course, it was all unconstitutional. This is what Jefferson pointed out. Okay, but it's all unconstitutional. Rejecting Smith, Hamilton declared himself the economic heir to the great Colbert. True, he's a mercantilist. See, what the problem with this piece is that it's a little dishonest. Soule is being a little dishonest. This is not securonomics. This is mercantilism. So the whole point of mercantilism was to suck wealth into the center, away from the population, put it into the center, to the nation, to the government, to the establishment political class. That's what you do with it, and you enrich the center. This is all true. Hamilton's policy slowly prevailed. With the support of James Madison, he managed to get the Tariff of 1790 enacted. Maintaining such policies was difficult given the opposition to the cost of subsidies from both Federalists and Republicans. However, constant worry about foreign threats meant that not only did Hamilton's protectionist policy hold, it also gained traction as conflict with Britain exploded into the War of 1812, inspiring more tariff policies. By 1816, even Thomas Jefferson, an admirer of Smith and one of protection's strongest opponents, had come to agree that a national manufacturing policy was necessary to the economy and to independence itself. Jefferson says he's supportive of manufacturing. He didn't say a national manufacturing policy. What Calhoun would later say, who of course supported that tariff of 1816, is a revenue-producing tariff. We're going to get revenue. There's going to be a byproduct where there's going to be some small-scale protection, but we're not talking about tariffs of 60% or anything else, which is essentially what this Soule will criticize Donald Trump for saying. This is going to destroy everything. That's what the Hamiltonians wanted. They wanted higher tariffs like that. They wanted protection. By the time you get to 1830s, this is what they're pushing for. This shift enshrined a Hamiltonian tradition of industrial strategy based on national security safety concerns as a hallmark of foreign policy. From the War of 1812 onward, Secretary of State Henry Clay continued Hamilton's economic policy with his own successful American system of protectionism along with military and industrial investment in order to compete with the British free market policies. And again, this is just, it is Hamiltonianism. I mean, he's pointing all this out. This is all true, but he's leaving some important parts out. Most importantly, the effect on the Constitution. In the 20th century, national economic strategy continued to be central to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's wartime policies and to Cold War strategies of technological investment. The idea was that if America had a possible military weakness, the government would step in to foster the industries necessary for military defense. Silicon Valley grew, in part from investments by the National Security Agency and the CIA, and radio wave and military research at Stanford. Cisco and IBM got off the ground with federal funds and contracts. Even as he liberalized the economy, Ronald Reagan maintained an industrial policy aimed at burying what his administration saw as sunset industries like steel and cars to focus on high-tech industries like fiber optics, particularly useful for military purposes. This is all true. What did I say? You've got massive government subsidies making all of these people. Silicon Valley wouldn't exist in many ways without government subsidies. So corporatism, this is, yeah, we live in a Hamiltonian world that people complain about constantly because it's dangerous. It's dangerous. Times have changed, but the Hamiltonian roots of American economic policy remain in place. Yes, this is why Hamilton screwed up America. Not just Hamiltonian economic policy, which I do address in the book, but also Hamiltonian government policy and legal policy. It's all there. You gotta get the book. Few on the right, acknowledge that Mr. Biden's CHIPS and Science and Inflation, Science Act and Inflation Reduction Act have also come as a response to the very state subsidies they complain about, and which have scored successes in supporting Chinese industry in the important domains of computers, cell phones, solar power, and electric cars. China's BYD has become the biggest electric vehicle producer worldwide, putting pressure on Tesla and other American companies. With recent chip technology breakthrough, China is rapidly catching up to the United States in semiconductor capacity, precisely because of state strategy and support. So basically, we need to be China. Government intervention and research investment in semiconductors could be seen as a gamble, but they in no way constitute a radical departure for American policy. Mr. Biden's economic plans look even more Hamiltonian in contrast with Donald Trump's suggested 10% tariffs on all imports and 60% tariffs on all Chinese goods. This is a very confusing statement to me, because Hamilton supported tariffs. In fact, the tariff policies were Hamiltonian. This is weird. It's a weird statement. I'm a little confused about what he means by this. Republican leaders have yet to weigh in on these disastrous proposals, in spite of leading economists of all stripes predicting dire consequences for the American economy, let alone security alliances if they were adopted. Hamilton's main concern was that America compete successfully to build industry to defend itself. He was looking to protect the future prospects of a fledgling nation and a hostile world of industrially and militarily powerful countries. He did not hesitate to bring the state into the equation. With neo-Hamiltonian securonomics, Mr. Biden is doing the same. This alone is a reason to vote against Biden, but of course there's nobody out there that's any better. Donald Trump is a Hamiltonian too. They're all Hamiltonians. This is the point. We live in a Hamiltonian-Lincolnian world. This last sentence, though, is really funny. In an age of rising autocracy and militarism around the world. Well, why is that? Because they all adopted these policies. The autocracy and militarism is only possible because of Hamiltonian policies. The president is thinking not just tactically in terms of the country's economic well-being, but also strategically about how industrial policy is crucial to America's security in every sense of the word. The Jeffersonians were against the military-industrial complex, what we would call that. We have it because other powers did it. So we just got to, this is what we got to do. Of course, Jefferson said, we got these big oceans between us. Even Biden said that, we got these big oceans. Well, that would be a way to kind of avoid some of these things. But no, we got to go whole hog into this and have this Hamiltonian system. So I found this to be fascinating. Again, get my book. I talk about all this stuff. What happens with Hamilton? I agree, Biden is a Hamiltonian. So is everybody else. If you want a real counterweight to that, it's not the Republican Party, who are Hamiltonian their own. I mean, look, Trump is advocating a Hamiltonian position. They're all Hamiltonians. The end of the piece is very confusing because he's arguing that Biden's being Hamiltonian for opposing a Hamiltonian position. The Democrats are Hamiltonian for opposing a Republican Hamiltonian position. It's very strange. It's very strange. They're all Hamiltonians. They're all Lincolnians. We live in the Lincolnian nightmare. And because without Hamilton, there's no Lincoln, the Hamiltonian nightmare. See you next time with the Brian McClanahan Show. See you then.